All right, people. We're going to see if I do it three times in a row where I hear myself 20 seconds into the stream echoing in the back screen. I have a very modest setup in the basement. I have two lights, one computer, and a mic, which I love this mic. How good is this mic, everyone? So, you know, when I go live, I don't have two screens that I can control. I'm actually using my kid's computer now because I forgot the adapter cable for my computer. Long story. Good evening, everybody. This is going to be another great sidebar. Jack Murphy, a name I didn't know until Robert Barnes introduced me to the name. And I went because I do my homework before most interviews, before all interviews. I do a great deal of homework. And my homework of the day consisted of listening to his book to get to know who I was going to be talking to, what we're going to be talking about, and, you know, the individual behind all of this. The book, his book is called Democrat to Deplorable. And it's his journey, his life experience from a diehard Democrat to, I would say, among the most diehards of deplorables. And it's a very interesting book. It's very interesting to read. I can see, as a lawyer, one can see how people can have problems with the contents of the book. And you know how it can be demonized the way people demonize ideas that they dislike these days. So it's going to be very interesting. The mic is good. Everything's good here. The lighting is good. Standard super chat, standard intro disclaimers. I didn't put slow mode on because I think I should be able to handle it. Spammers and overt threats of direct aggression are the only things that actually get blocked. So don't spam and don't abuse of the fact that I'm not on slow mode. I think I can handle it. Super chats. If I don't get to your super chat, don't be miffed. If you're going to be miffed, if I don't read your super chat with my lips and out loud, don't give it because I don't like people feeling rooked or people don't seem to understand that when you say F, I am very sensitive and I take it seriously. Yeah, the picnic table shirt's up. I may need to get a new shirt. And maybe one that's black so the mic is camouflaged better. So, super chats. If I don't get to the super chats, don't be angry. I saw someone say support Rebel News, support Viva and Barnes. I would even say support Rebel News first because they are, you know, I know what I do and I know what they do. And they are on the front line of doing that, which few people are doing. And they fight, you know, when people say fight the tickets, everything, all this, they are supporting that in their endeavors. And they're covering stories that mainstream media is just not covering, like what's going on in Alberta today, barricading a church. I put out a tweet. I said, you know, barricading churches, forced invasive tests, stay-at-home orders, indefinite curfews, forced detention in government facilities with no due process. Pick your country and pick your era. Wrong answers only, because spoiler alert, it's Canada 2021. We just get 500 rubles, which officially makes me Russian agents. Jack Murphy, nice. Mayhaps we'll see James Lindsay, Michael Malice, or Jack Posobiec sometime later. They're all on the menu. They're all in the works, I think, based on what I recognize of those names. And for any, I noticed someone who said, oh, it's turning into the nice echo chamber. First of all, that's selective viewing because I have Nate on. I've had Leonard French on. I've had people who are definitely not of a certain political persuasion. But there is a difference between an echo chamber and people who don't have the courage to accept invitations to debate. I'm not thinking of any leftist journalists who challenged me to a debate, then refused when I accepted and set all the parameters. So it's nice when people refuse to have a discussion and then the ideological adversaries get to say, look, you're only talking to a certain group of people, therefore it's an echo chamber because nobody has the courage on certain positions to come and debate them in an open format or even discuss them. What I love is when I extend an invite, I know who says yes and I know who says no. And I know when they say yes, the no follow-up questions, when people don't ask, what are you going to ask me? I like that. Open to debate, not afraid of defending their ideas, and not afraid of a discussion that will be analyzed and nitpicked and dissected by a very intelligent crowd that we have in the chat. So on that note, I missed the Batman dad. Mr. Frobot says, I might be miffed if you read this. Well, let me see if I can get it. Oh, there it is. Okay, Mr. Frobot. So that is it. This is the intro. I've given 5 minutes. YouTube is not all that good with notifications, but whatever. I've tweeted it, messaged it. Jack Murphy, the intro. I mean, I'm not even going to give the intro. We're going to let Jack give the intro. And look at that. Just in time, Barnes is in the house. So we're going to go. Barnes, because it allows me to bring in Jack. It allows me to go this way. And now we have the Brady Bunch of open discourse. Jack, Robert, how you guys doing?
Good, good.
Doing great. Happy to be here.
All right, Jack. So, I mean, I gave the brief intro. The first thing is, and I'm going to have to ask it because your beard was not quite as majestic in the picture that I pulled from the internet. How long does it take to grow a beard like that? And are the two colors natural or not natural?
Definitely 100% natural. People ask me that all the time. Why would I dye it like this if I'm going to dye it at all? I'd go all the way, I think. Definitely 100% natural. And I used to keep it a little bit shorter, but then quarantine happened and I was growing a quarantine beard. And I was thinking, I'm not going to trim it until, you know, we win the Stanley Cup or whatever. Well, that never happened. So, and then at the same time, all through 2020, my social media profile exploded and it's now part of the brand. So here we are and I'm happy about it.
Well, it is beautiful. And I'm going to have to ask a scientist, what would account for the clear linear, like the linear delimitation of the change of colors? It's fascinating, actually, just from an actual growth perspective. Okay, Jack, sorry about that. I had to get that out of the way.
No sweat.
Tell the crowd who may not know who you are before we get into the nitty gritty of the cross examinations.
Sure. It's pretty wild because, you know, you asked me a couple of years ago, I'd have a different story, right? Who am I today? Today, I'm a full-time media professional. I do interviews. I have a podcast. I produce content every single day. And I am the founder of the Liminal Order, which is an all men's organization based on shared and common values. And we have 500 guys all around the world, and we work together to promote our values of masculinity, brotherhood, and sovereignty, which we see as an antidote, part of the answer to all of the problems that we face today. Now, if you would have asked me this question 5 years ago, I could tell you that I was an executive director of charter schools, and I was a regulator of charter schools in Washington, D.C. You asked me that 10 years before that, I was a full-time real estate developer. Before that, I was a private equity and hedge fund guy. So I've had a lot of different careers and a lot of changes, but I'll tell you, this one that I've got right now, 5 years in the making, social media, interviews, content creation, leading the Liminal Order. This is the career I was made for. And I have never been happier or more aligned in my life with my values, my action, my mission than ever today. And man, it just feels great.
Okay, that's amazing. So let's actually, starting from the beginning, I'm going to get to some super chats afterwards, but starting from the beginning, you wrote a book, From Democrat to Deplorable, or Democrat to Deplorable, documenting your journey. Mm-hmm. The journey started from, I guess it started earlier, but with your childhood upbringing, coming from a mixed religious, sort of mixed culture, family and marriage.
Yeah, I'm half Irish Catholic, half Russian Jew, Ashkenazi. I was bar mitzvahed. I went to, you know, Catholic mass. I had both sides on both sides of the family. None of that really stuck, though, into adulthood. And I became more of an atheist than anything. But now, actually, talking about journeys, I am as close to becoming a believer and ever before in my life, a return to spirituality, seeing the dire need for it in my personal life and in our society. And so I'm actually much more attracted to that now than I was before. But I did start with the story about my childhood because it was about two separate cultures. It was about two cultures coming together. It was a parallel story and theme and framework for the book. Also, as a child, I was bused from the northern suburbs of Fort Wayne, Indiana, into the city as part of forced desegregation. So I lived that social experiment out on a daily basis, coming from the suburbs, going into the city, watching the terrain change, the attitudes change, the people change, the energy change. And I experienced that social experiment firsthand, and that stuck with me. And I was always really aware of bridging two cultures and bridging two places and sort of being a go-between two worlds. And so this transformation from, well, personally, I don't think I transformed very much at all. The country rocketed to my left. And so where I was, you know, basically like a small L libertarian liberal, don't mess with me, I won't mess with you, basics. Just sort of standing still, the country just shot to the left, and all of a sudden I'm far right now. And I never even changed one belief. And ironically of all, the libertarian in me is dying every day. And my appreciation my aversion to government influence in matters is declining. And I can see the strong need that we may have for government influence. So in some ways, I've actually become more of a leftist in the old terms over time, even as the world's been rocketing to my left and leaving me out here on what some people might call the far right.
Could you explain that a little bit more? In other words, what do you mean? What aspects of governmental involvement do you see as more morally or philosophically justifiable now than you did in the past?
Sure. So, I mean, look, I'm friendly and familiar with the folks at Reason. They have an office here in DC. I've been to a number of their parties. I know a bunch of the writers. And, you know, I can just hear in my head, it's like, but it's private business, private company can do whatever they want. Well, that's great. But what if a private company went around and bought up all the bridges and said, you guys can't cross these bridges. You can travel 500 miles up the river and ford your way across. But hey, you can't be crossing this bridge. That's not something that we would be into. And I feel like that's kind of where we are with social media. The early mover advantage, they've clearly have the public square in their control. And now, interestingly, they're acting in concert with the Democratic government. So is the government going to be an answer? Probably not this administration, especially seeing some of the people that they've staffed up both sides in the DOJ and now working for Facebook, et cetera, back and forth. Matt Stoller's really been on top of those hires and tracking the antitrust or not efforts of the Biden administration. But, you know, the public square has been captured by social media. And, you know, it seems to me that there is at least a conversation to be had. Whereas in my past, I would have just been like Ayn Rand on everything. Just no government, no nothing. Just leave me alone. I can take care of everything. Private business. And, you know, that power, you know, that idea has diminished a little bit. You know, the technology at work here is so vast and so powerful. And we're on the precipice of AI taking over a lot of these functions. And if we don't have these companies sort of doing the right thing for everyone, we could be facing what John Robb, the strategist, calls the long night, you know, the long night of tyranny. Ask people in Hong Kong what it's like when the government and technology fuse into a fascist state to limit your freedoms. That's where we're headed right now. And so will the free market solve every problem? I don't believe that anymore. Whereas I may have in the past, I may have even argued it very, very passionately, especially in my early years. Someone once called me and some of my online associates MAGA socialists as a joke, as an insult. But hey, you know, there is some logic to the notion that the government is here to actually protect us. And it might be a time for us to rely on that just a little bit more.
So I mean, actually, there's a lot of things that I want to get into the liminal group in a bit, actually. But the story of the busing you into another schooling to, you know, force desegregation. I mean, can you explain what that looks like and what that feels like as a kid, and as an example of how government policy actually, as benevolent as it purports to want to be, actually has the exact opposite effect of its purported stated intention, if we assume that that was an actual intention in the first place?
Well, in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and Allen County, Indiana, they tried actual forced, compelled desegregation, where like they went into black neighborhoods and they're like, you got to send your kids 50 miles away to this country bumpkin high school, and you don't have any choice in the matter. Same thing with the kids in suburbs. That was a disaster, right? Everyone hated that. And part of the research for the book was going back to the original texts and original documents and interviews with high school kids in the 70s and parents and stuff. And it was very interesting to get that flavor. When it was my chance, you know, they had evolved the process a little bit into using magnet schools, right? So it was like, we'll incentivize you to do this. And so, you know, we were all these nerds, basically, from the suburbs, piled on these buses and drove into the inner city. And then we co-populated there with kids from that neighborhood. And the whole reason they put us there is because the neighborhood was depressed. It was crime ridden. It was exclusively African American. And one of the things that really stood out to me, and I talked about this in the book, was we would get off the buses And we'd be going, you know, into the classroom, or we'd come out and have recess on the playground. And there was always like 30 or 40 men in their 20s playing basketball all day, like just all day, just like grown men, working age, playing basketball, just hanging out in the street. We didn't see anything like that where I grew up in the suburbs. You know, everybody left to go to work and everybody came home afterwards. To just see so many men of working age. And of course, it just didn't all register for me at the time. And I'm looking back and I can experience these feelings now as an adult. So maybe they're, you know, maybe I'm backwards applying some of this logic here, but it struck me. And it was very strange. And it was very strange just to see the dilapidated nature of the sidewalks and the buildings. And just, I got in so many fights in that school too. I was always fighting, not me. They were coming to me. I was always fighting with the local kids. It just didn't, I don't know that it had the desired effect. I don't know what the desired effect was. I read now, you know, and understand that there is a strain of thought that says black children will do better at school if they just go to school with white kids. I mean, it sounds crazy when I say it like that, but that's actually in the literature, that if they could just go to white schools, they'll get a better education. Maybe that was part of it. I don't know. It seems like a radical thing. It seemed like a radical idea then. It seems like a radical idea now. And here's a bookend. Okay. Just today, I'm driving with my kids in the car, and on the back of a bus in front of me, there was an advertisement for a DC public school that was for boys of color only. A public school, publicly funded for boys of color only. Now that is that 360? Is that 180? I don't know. That is a crazy bookend in 2021 now. Public advertisement, public school promoting it for only boys of color. I don't think that's legal, but I'm not a lawyer. Do you guys know any? Anyway, the point is like this idea of us forcing people to come together and then trying to incentivize people to come together has now resulted us in being like, everybody stay apart. And one last bit on this. As a charter school executive director, I've worked in education for 10 years. I regulated charter schools in DC. I was the top financial regulator in DC for charter schools. And what we saw is people self-segregate. The schools open up, they staff up with a bunch of people of color, or they staff up with some white folks or whatever, and the students self-segregate. They self-segregate. It's a very interesting phenomenon, I guess, or is it human nature? I don't know. I do believe in free markets in some sense in this where people should have the choice of where they go to school, right? And I am a school choice advocate for sure. But it is an interesting phenomenon to see that when given the opportunity, they self-segregate. And then at the same time, now we have DC public school taxpayer funded saying this is a school for boys of color only. Crazy, crazy journey we've been on now. It's 40 years.
Now, how many kids do you have, and how much has being a father influenced your cultural, political, public engagement?
Yeesh. It's a good one. I have three children, 15, 14, and 8. And I never intended to be a public figure, Craig. I never intended to be a public figure. I started my Twitter account pseudonymously. Jack Murphy's not my full legal name. My full legal name is John Murphy Goldman. My grandfather's name was John Murphy. I was named after him. Everybody called him Jack, so I went with Jack Murphy. And it was meant to be secret. And eventually I ended up getting doxxed when I had very few followers and no influence. Antifa came after me. They isolated me. They targeted me. They went after my employers. They went to my Little League board. They got me banned from coaching Little League. They got me fired from my job. That made me a public figure. And from there, I used that energy to grow the brand and grow my influence and to grow my social media output. So I never made a conscious decision to become a public figure. And so I never made that calculus in terms of how would this impact my children. Today, they are very aware of my job. In fact, as we were just getting ready, you know, my girlfriend was putting makeup on, and the kids were putting their face in the camera, and they're outside eating dinner right now. And, you know, they know, and they listen to me. And so I'm regularly preaching to them. In fact, every single day I preach to them. And I don't have to come up with abstract examples to preach. I take the emails that their principal sends to me. For example, the day after massage parlor shooting, where that guy went in there and killed, what, like six Asian ladies and two white ladies or something like that? Mm-hmm. Before the blood was cleaned up off the floor of that massage parlor, the principal had sent out an email and said, Asian hate crime, white supremacy, we're going to have counselors available if you want to come talk about it, Asian hate crimes, white supremacy, yada, yada, yada. Didn't even wait for 1 second to see what actually happened. Didn't care about the facts, nothing. So I have very concrete examples to sit down with my kids and talk to them about. And I do. And I regularly do. And, you know, in terms of their friends knowing who I am and whatnot, they don't tell anybody, you know, they keep that part pretty secret, I think.
So it's in your book. So I'm not prying, although I'm going to pry a little more than what was in your book. You got married at 24, yeah. Divorced, three kids, then divorced by 33.
Yeah.
So it's that the book didn't go into too much detail in the book, but I'm going to take a guess that you're not on speaking terms with your ex.
We are now officially on speaking terms. It took me 12 years. As a matter of fact, tonight, which is, I scheduled this 2 months ago. Tonight is the first night that the kids are here in our new 50-50 equal share. It took me 12 years, four different lawyers, multiple lawsuits, all kinds of work. Finally, no offense, guys, I represented myself. And that was the final piece because there was no leverage over me on fees. I was like, come on, we're just doing this. And it worked out in that respect. But no, we're on speaking terms now because I got what I want. I wanted my kids 50-50. Here we have them. I've been fighting for them this whole time. And they're here. And it's wonderful. It's been that's another sort of bookend. I'm at this place in my life right now, man, where like I'm having to rewrite my whole new plan. 5 years ago, I didn't know where I was really going. Start the liminal order. We're already 2 years in. We're 5 years plan. The 5-year plan has already been achieved. Social media is blowing up. I got my kids here. Everything's great. Now I have to revision myself for the future to see where we're going to go.
I'm just reading some of the chats. Look, I've never touched family law specifically for this reason. Commercial litigation is nasty enough. When you throw in kids and you throw in two people who aren't getting along, you're dealing with humans and not money. And I think I've found more often than not that lawyers tend to make things worse in family disputes and not better. And you're lucky if you find a lawyer that actually actively makes things better. My experience, take it for what it's worth, I think most people are going to probably agree with that. But, you know, in the
no one goes to law school saying, I'm going to finish top of my class and end up doing family law.
It's lucrative. It's lucrative.
Maybe in parts of Manhattan and Beverly Hills.
True, perhaps,
but that's a different kind of family law. Right, I did a lot of family law, but I was representing a lot of victims of domestic violence and domestic abuse cases, stalker cases. But what I would say as part of that whole process is that I learned early. I'm curious whether your experience with it, it's really a place when people ask me about gender in law. I say that even though 98% of my clients were women and children, I will tell you that in the legal system, in family law, there's extraordinary discrimination and presumptions against men. Definitely. And you even have the famous case of the judge who said, well, I've been watching ducks for a long time and they always follow the mama duck. So I'm just going to award custody that way. And in particular, that's where you get, you know, it hurt my cases that other people would fake allegations of abuse, fake allegations of this. That's when people told me no one would ever lie about this. I was like, I witnessed, I had a client do it once, didn't know it until they're on the stand. That's not a fun position to be in, but that's another story. To what degree was your experience in that? Usually it's shocking because most Americans just have this assumption about the legal system is fair and just. And when they go through it in the family law system, particularly men, they tend to experience the worst of it and see just overt gender bias by almost everybody, guardians ad litem, judges, you name it. Was that your experience? Was it surprising? And how did it shape your perception of the legal world?
So it's a great question. at the time of the divorce, I was so lost mentally, emotionally, spiritually, financially. We got separated in 2008, divorced 2009. I was a real estate developer. Remember I mentioned that? 8 years of real estate development, right down the tubes right at that time. And so the family business we had built was falling apart. I was a mess, so much pain. I just wanted the pain to end. And I'll be the first to admit, I agreed to a bad schedule. And I didn't know. And I had no idea. It was only until I did a lot more research and figured things out and my head cleared and I started to gain my senses again that I realized, yes, predominantly the experiences for men across this country are very negative and biased when it comes to family law. However, in Washington, D.C., one of the progressive elements in Washington, D.C. is a presumption of equal time with the father and mother in D.C. Now, it took me 12 years to get to that point once the first deal was done. Redoing these deals are impossible. There has to be a material and unanticipated change in circumstances, okay? And if you get divorced at two and the kids are 14, them being 12 years older is not an unanticipated change of circumstances according to the law. And so in order to get things changed, I had to either fabricate, come up with, or figure out some way to make the point that there was a material and unexpected change in circumstances. And so she hung on to that as a way to not let this happen. And finally, it just took grinding her down. I know she tracks and stalks my Twitter all the time. I'm very public about all of it. And then finally, one day, my son, finally, for him, kudos to him, was like, "Mom, what the hell? Why isn't it 50-50? Why can't I see my dad?" And that for her was the final piece, I think. But it was a grind, man. It was a long struggle. And we literally, this is the day today, right? This very moment right now is the first day of the new rest of our lives with the 50-50. And I couldn't be any happier about it. So just one last bit on that. My number one advice to fathers who are going through a divorce or anticipating a divorce: no matter how little money you think you have, and no matter how much you may hate lawyers, hire the best lawyer you possibly can. If anything, just to be made aware of your options, because there are things that you don't know. You don't know. And in that condition and in that state of mind, either you're disappointed that she's leaving you or you're excited to be getting the hell out of there. But either way, your mind is not right. Hire somebody to help you.
This is it's the old expression, you know, not to say that someone who represents themselves has the fool for a client, but it is your emotion. Doctors cannot perform surgery on themselves unless they're in the Antarctica and have to remove their appendix. You're in pain. You don't assess things properly, and you need the objective counsel of an external, you know, unbiased source or bias in your favor, but someone who's going to look out for you. But so you're getting divorced now, 8 years in. You have three kids, 8, 7, and 4 at the time.
It's a little more complicated than that, but we can go with that.
Okay, no. So without getting into it too much, but you get.
There's another mother. There's another mother, just to clear that up.
Okay.
After the divorce.
Well, that complicates matters now. So let's not get into that, but this is the beginning of the journey where this is the beginning in your mind of the journey where you go from Democrat to deplorable. Why does it signify the beginning? And yeah, what does it signify the beginning? How was this the catalyst that pushed you into the new trajectory?
Sure, the divorce. So in 2009, I'm single. I'm 33. I'm 34 years old. And I'm like, all right, let's see what's going on out there. And boy, the whole world had changed. I had not been single for 10 years. Imagine how different the dating world was from 99 to 2009. There wasn't any cell phones, much less Tinder. When I was dating in the 90s, people went to bars, they smoked cigarettes, drank beer, and met somebody at the bar. That's how you did it. And it was a whole new world. So I had to figure it out. And that is how I began what I would call the red pill process. When you start to figure out the truth behind everything. The truth behind male-female dynamics, the truth behind the government, the truth behind the media, behind the law, behind the wars that we have fought, behind the narratives flying around everywhere. And you just, me sitting in this chair right here, right now, talking to you guys, is me pulling on the very same thread now for 10 years. What is going on with dating and mating? And then just pulling that thread. Oh, what's feminism? What's radical feminism? Oh, crap. Then I started learning about that. I started learning evolutionary psychology. I started learning about narratives and why people would tell you things that weren't true and why men would be manipulated and what cunning and guile is and how women use men as proxies for their own force. I didn't understand any of that stuff prior. No need. You know, I was a, what do you call it? I was like an unaware Chad, I guess. I'm 6'4". I'm smart. I've never not had a girlfriend. I would turn around, there'd be one standing there, you know, as soon as I was ready for the next. But I had to figure it out at 33. It was different. And once I started figuring it out, once I started understanding feminism and gender dynamics, and then seeing how feminist ideology was actually bigger than that, and then how it got wrapped up in with the race stuff and with critical theory, and then seeing how it was in the universities. One of the main red pilling moments for me along this way was the Rolling Stone rape hoax at UVA. Mm-hmm. And it was, what is that, like 2013, 2014? You know, it was right after Duke won as well. And that was such a great example of how the world just wants to be like, man, men are the worst. They're raping girls. They're just insane. And it didn't matter. Truth didn't matter. These people's lives didn't matter. It was all about narrative. And that was when I was like, man, okay. Okay. Then the Title IX stuff, you know, where due process has been limited for men on campus who are, or anyone really, who's accused of sexual harassment. And then I just started digging, man. I'm curious. I'm an autodidact. I just kept pulling and pulling and pulling. And once you get into that world and you start to really understand it, then the big pictures open up. And it's been that process of trying to figure out how to get laid after my divorce, which opened this whole universe for me to now understand exactly what critical race theory is, how it works in the schools, why they're implementing it, what it means for our politics, what it means for our government, what it means for Western civilization. And it is no joke to say that, like, I went from figuring out how to work Tinder all the way through to, boy, like, Western civilization is in a crisis. And if we don't do something about it, it's actually going to die. And so, like I said, same thread. And I think there's a lot of guys like me. The divorce process is a red pilling process for men. It opens them up to realities. It forces them to re-examine their assumptions about the world, reassess their mental models for fitness. Like, is this really working for me? And then, you know, once you sort of move down that path, a lot of other truths become evident.
Yeah, I want to get into but before I get into the sort of your democratization of cultural philosophy as it relates to the, in general, against the sort of media monopoly on the means of production and those aspects. Mm-hmm. But before I get into that, there was one aspect you mentioned that this all happens initially, at least in part, because of a public trauma that really awakened a wide range of people, which was the 2008 financial crash. Yes. That had a specific individual influence on you, but it politically awakens everybody from Steve Bannon to Salty Cracker. And there's a wide range of people in that context that 2008 created a shift, a mindset shift in broad that sent people on a wide range of inquiries into disbelieving the institutional narrative and seeking their own solutions. To yeah. what degree, if 2008 financial crisis never happens, your real estate business is still booming. Do you take the same trajectory, or how influential was it on the trajectory it took?
I'm getting like goosebumps right now thinking about the power of the financial crash in my life. So let me give you some context. I worked in fixed income hedge fund, right? So I was an expert bond trader. Well, I wasn't the expert bond trader. There's a portfolio manager. I worked for him. I understand fixed income, how it works. I understand mortgage-backed securities, commercial mortgage-backed securities. And I knew as early as 2005, 2006, that the housing market was nuts and the financing market was nuts. And I knew that from a fixed income, high level financial perspective. Then, as I'm also now a real estate developer, I am building and selling condominiums to people who are showing up at closing with no income, no asset mortgages, with a first, second, and third trust and a grant to buy a condo for 200 grand that I know they can't afford. Okay. So I lived the real estate bubble and the financial, you know, mayhem leading up to the crisis on every level. And I was involved in a very popular blog back then called Calculated Risk that really broke the housing bubble news way early, like 2006, we were on top of it. So I like lived every moment of it from every perspective. And when the whole thing went to crap and the whole thing died and my business died and I went up in smoke, up in drink, actually, you know, at that time. You know, when the bailouts didn't happen for the homeowners, when the foreclosure bailouts didn't happen, when the banks, when AIG and Goldman got bailed out and no one else did really, with Hank Paulson and all those guys, man, that, you know, that red pilled a lot of people who were maybe, you know, some people a little bit older than me at that time. And that was huge, man. Civilizational change, like, level for us, because it really pulled the curtain back. Bush and Obama working together with the TARP stuff. You know, there was seamless transition from Bush to Obama on the TARP project. I don't know if people really realize that like it was Bush who started it. And then it was Obama that doubled down and made it even worse and totally screwed all of the working class homeowners that got hoodwinked, and especially the minority mortgage holders who probably shouldn't have gotten the mortgages in the first place. And I don't mean minorities. I just mean anybody with poor income and assets and bad credit. You know, the liquidity was so massive that everybody got a loan who wanted one. Hell, you could get three of them. And then they didn't protect anybody after that. So that definitely woke a lot of people up. A lot of people.
It's an amazing thing, because you don't fully appreciate these awakening moments unless you're conscious at the time and you live through them. And I go back now and reassess my understanding of 9/11 and the ensuing wars, the invasion of Iraq, and the expert FBI reports of weapons of mass destruction. And knowing what I know now, my goodness, if I had known then, I would have viewed things and analyzed things totally differently. And, you know, my eye-opening experience, I think I'm younger than you, but my eye-opening experience has started with this channel and just pulling the thread on legal cases and then seeing how it's corruption all the way down. And, you know, so it's an amazing journey, so to speak, where you're brought up taking for granted certain political truths, and then you discover that they're not truths whatsoever.
Here's how in the tank I was in the Iraq invasion. The premise, the United Nations Security Council had sanctioned Iraq and demanded that we let in nuclear inspectors. They didn't. They refused and rejected and kicked out the inspectors. So I was like, all right, let's go to war. That seemed pretty cut and dry to me, actually, at the time, because why? I had faith and confidence in our international institutions. I had faith and confidence in the United Nations. I had faith and confidence in the government. Even as much as I was a rebel growing up in the 90s, you know, that caught the tail end of punk in DC. I was like a rave DJ and a promoter and underground guy. As much as I was a rebel in all those elements, you know, I still had some trust. I still had some trust, and that trust is completely gone now. 100% evaporated at this point.
But now this is the one issue I had reading your book, because, or listening
to
it.
Just one.
Well, no, I say that when I'm listening to it, and I say, I can understand people are going to take issue with some arguments. They're going to take issue with the way you describe feminism. The people are going to, if they want to, frame the book as man gets married, man has kids, man gets divorced, man gets angry, becomes a deplorable. So, and now it's the oversimplified way of looking at it, but you know that people are just, if they want to write it off, that's how they're going to write it off. You need to go into some detail to explain to the crowd the incident at the school, but when you were the school commissioner, I forget the title.
Yeah, I was executive director. I was executive director of a charter school, and my job was to turn charter school around, right? My job was to go in and fix the worst performing schools in Washington, D.C. So what did I do? I go in, I clear house, redo the budget, redo everything. And guess what? We are on our way. We are 90 yards down a 100-yard field to the goal. And the board of directors at that time that I had, they were all white, all women, a handful of men. And they wanted to get rid of me because I was a white man. And they said it. And they were obvious and open about it. And the way they got me out was they fabricated they said that I created a hostile work environment for my black female principal that I hired, trained, promoted, and gave bonuses to. who I also retained. And our, you know, retention rate for the teachers was like exceeded the threshold put in my performance metrics. I exceeded every one of the performance goals on every metric: student performance, teacher retention, test scores, attendance, finances, budget, reserve, cash amount, all of it, exceeded all of it. And they still wanted to get rid of me. Why? I was a white man. And I, you know what? I hired a firm that was headed up by a white guy also. Don't forget, there were women partners also in that same firm. And they concocted, in collaboration with this woman, a story that I created a hostile work environment for my black female principal. Now, they said they were going to investigate me. Okay, where's the investigation? They said there was a complaint. Where's the complaint? There was no complaint. There was no investigation. It was just totally fabricated out of nowhere. All the teachers love me. All the staff love me. We were winning. And they just wanted to get rid of me because I was a white guy. Well, they got rid of me. They got rid of me. And you know what happened? That school is closed and dead now because they failed. They failed. Those kids were failed. Those parents that invest all that time and energy in that school, all of that wasted because these people want, and man, when I, there's no doubt in my mind, when you go and look at the profiles of the board members, they're all equity, this progressive, that blah, 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 all the buzzwords. And, you know, they sacrifice those children at the altar of their progressive ideals and their greed to get rid of a white guy. And the school's gone and done.
And in that capacity, a common theme through whether we're talking about culture, whether we're talking about foreign war, whether we're talking about aspects of domestic economics or your experience in public education, is this increasing willingness to sacrifice efficacy, however that's measured, profits in the case of Disney, having a war that doesn't backfire in any of the foreign wars, now Ukraine, other places where we're talking about going, or in the context of education. The name of the game is supposed to be improving the well-being of children. In this case, you're predominantly African-American children in an area that's been historically distressed. And the reality is they don't care about that at all. They're willing to sacrifice that for some political god. I mean, that's where you've that a lot of this is quasi-religious in nature and is attempting to replace religion and this and this and the value that religion provides to people with its own form of idolatry. To what degree did that experience? Well, first, before we get into that, what led you to be interested in doing charter school work in the first place?
I love kids. I love kids. And in Washington, D.C., the I will save the schools mountaintop is littered with skeletons of successful people who thought I'm going to be the one to fix DC schools. So there was a little bit of a challenge there. I'm from DC. I mean, I've been here since 1990. I wanted to make a difference and I had an opportunity to do it. And the sad part is that the data bears out everything that I said, because you know what? They fired me. I was hired then literally the next day I was hired by another school in DC. And within 2 years, I completed a 5-year turnaround plan. The mayor himself came down to the school, thanked me personally, shook hands with me, pictures, everything. So it was clearly had nothing to do with my performance because I left that one school and went and did the same thing again at another school. So that part of it to me, it really was, it was sort of the end of any sort of vision, dream, fantasy, you know, that like grownups act responsibly. Right? They just simply don't. I remember when I was an intern as a young kid in college and I was excited. I was like, man, I'm going to get to this place and everybody's going to be so smart and everybody's going to be so professional and hardworking and whatever. And you get there and you're like, God damn, man, it's just like high school again.
You know, it's a funny.
It never happens.
Your experience was from the perspective of, you know, woke progressive politics. Mine, when I worked at a big law firm, was just politics. It's, you know,
yeah.
There is, people are going to find something to fight about. So it's either going to be, you know, legit corporate issues, or it's going to be these other, you know, I don't say fabricated issues, but these other sort of created issues where you make standards that you have to meet. You create your own problems to some extent. The question, though, is the dirtiness of the fight. They make the allegations, and even, you know, listening to the book, I say it's too complicated. Even I, listening to it, don't know what to make of it. I know how fights get. I know they're dirty. I know there's always two, three, four sides to every story. So they come after you with these allegations. And then even by virtue of the fact that you have to publicly defend against them or even privately, you're already tarnished. I mean, what was the, what were the nature's specific allegations of the toxic work environment that you created?
That's the thing, dude. There wasn't even any specific allegations. All they had to say was you created a toxic work environment for the African-American female. There was no complaint. There was no investigation. There was none of that. And yet, even with exceeding my all performance metrics, and this is all FOIA-able information in case anybody doesn't believe me, it's all there. It's all there. So it was just a stark, naked power grab mixed with the racism and the sexism. And, you know, they sacrificed those kids' families and their experience for their greed and whatever. And they paid the price and karma got them. There's no pleasure. I get no pleasure in that. There is a slight vindication, but no pleasure. There's just, it's just sad. This, look, if Disney wants to screw its corporate shareholders out of some additional dividend because they chose to go woke, that's one thing. If a small nonprofit board ruins the lives of 1,000 families because they went woke, now that's totally different scale. And that is way more meaningful and powerful and detrimental in my mind. And you have to remember that these circumstances are recreated thousands of times across the country. Independent charter schools like this have their own boards. There's not that many competent people in America to staff that many school boards, right? In DC alone, there's like 60 of them. That's 12 times 60. You think that there's really that many capable, competent people willing to spend their time that are actually going to do something good? Or are these people motivated by something else? Power, greed, ego. And then the kids are the ones that get caught up in the crossfire. Very, very disheartening. And, you know, sometimes I think I'm an optimist. Sometimes I think I'm a cynic. I don't even know anymore. I still get burned, so I guess I'm an optimist.
Yeah, I think Michael Malice describes it as, in the end, sort of a white pill world, even if there's some black pills along the way.
Yeah.
I think one thing you mentioned is it's the power, you know, going back to Jacques, the power of the accusation. Yeah. When I remember debating this early in law school, when someone brought up the idea that nobody would ever fake a rape allegation, an assault allegation, an abuse allegation. And I was like, of course they would, because for the same reason that, yeah, that rape and sexual assault and abuse take place. Now, you know, those crimes are mostly more about power than they are about sexual desire. And it's the same as in reverse. There's power in the accusation. There's power to shift the equation. And that's why people do it. That's why people lie all the time, and they'll lie about anything and everything. And just the nature of the accusation can be so inflammatory. We're kind of seeing it with Matt Gaetz right now. Even if it turns out totally innocent, who's going to remember that? They're going to remember Matt Gaetz, sex trafficking, minor. They're trying to destroy and wreck his career all in one clean swipe. And you got to be the victim. But what's amazing about these cases, like, and this is sort of a good transition into the what's happening in Title IX, Biden's trying to bring back weaponizing college campuses with the sort of moral panic people can read about. I mean, there's a good book from two left-leaning Obama supporting writers who talk about how the whole campus rape mythology was a moral panic. It was not rooted in any empirical reality at all. And again, I'm someone who's represented victims of domestic abuse for a long time, almost always for free for 20 plus years. But the reality is that this is about a power grab. It's about who gets to accuse in the Title IX context, because there's so much power in the accusation itself. Truth doesn't matter. Justice doesn't matter. Efficacy doesn't matter. Only power matters. And accusation is a means of power. And you got the unfortunate experience of personally living it. To what degree did that reshape your perspective on some of those aspects?
That was the first time. The second time is the one that just put the final wrapping on the red pill. Totally 100%. You know, is when I got doxxed. This is after that event. Okay, I got doxxed by Antifa because I appeared in a picture with Chelsea Manning and Cassandra and Jack and Will and a few other people.
Well, oh yeah, remind me. So that wasn't at the New York party. Was that at
that
the
was at the New York party. That was at it the was. New York
okay,
party.
I was there. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But well, it was it came as a result of that. So a couple months That's before right.
you guys that got together, did a game.
We had gotten together to just socialize, yeah. right? Across the aisle. Like normal human beings, we had gotten together to socialize. And because she went to Mike Cernovich's A Night for Freedom in New York City in January, they that picture got it was what is that guy's name? Yashar Ali, that guy. He doxed me ultimately. And he's all, oh, cancel culture so bad. Dude, that dude posted a private picture of me when I was a private individual. That led to me being completely doxxed and my life ruined. And he's never taken responsibility for that. And he owes me, that guy. He even said that he was going to make amends and he never did. Anyway, the point is Antifa and the radical left saw that picture. They literally put the names above the heads of the other guys, Jack Posobiec, Will Chamberlain, and they put a question mark over my head. And then they went about figuring out who I was. And as soon as they figured out who I was, they said I was a Nazi. And they went to my employer. They went all over their Twitter feed. John Goldman, a.k.a. Jack Murphy, is a Nazi, white supremacist, blah, 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 blah. And that's all it took. That's all it took. Because the school board that I worked for at the time, how are they going to defend me, even if they thought I was right? There's no way that they could in a predominantly African-American work environment, predominantly African-American student population in D.C. They couldn't even have anybody with a whiff of that stuff around. So the accusation, even though totally disproven, even though it's totally inaccurate, even though I had literally just spent 10 years helping African-American students in D.C. get better educations, in spite of the white progressive ladies who were trying to screw everything up. The accusation was all that it took. And so that to me was, it was an indication that narrative is everything. Okay. Narrative is everything. Jewish Nazi. That's exactly right. That's me. Narrative is everything. And so I learned from that. And one of my most popular Twitter threads, 3 million views and counting, is the story, my whole story. And I constantly tell my story over and over and over and over and over again. Why? Because the power of narrative is so important. I will be the one to tell the world who I am. I will not allow anyone else to define who I am. I will not allow other people's accusations to define who I am. I have taken control of my narrative. And one way you have to do that is by telling it over and over and over and over and over and over again, probably for the rest of my life. And that learning that lesson is at once depressing and also empowering, because now I've learned how to channel the energy, right? You can use narrative, and if you're an honest broker like I am, you're putting together facts and using it to create a narrative that's real. But it's the narrative that you want, whereas the you know our opponents out there will selectively use facts to create the narrative that they want. It's really all about who says it first, who says it loudest, and who says it longest. And that has basically been my social media philosophy, and it has worked out pretty well to this point.
Well, and I think that's where, in terms of narrative, it's what unites good cognitive therapy for victims of abuse, particularly rape and assault as an example. Nelson Mandela, his ability to be a successful revolutionary while still inside of prison. And what you're talking about is that the ability that we are the captain of our own ship. We are the master of our own fate. And we do so by we control our self-narration. What story we tell ourselves about ourselves Indeed. Is incredible. It's like the U2 song, Silver and Gold. You know, outside I'm a prisoner, inside I'm free, because I choose to write my own story. I choose to tell my own story. No one else can take that from me. It's the one thing they cannot imprison the mind, at least not yet. Wait until AI and some other things, maybe, you know, Elon Musk is going to stick some stuff in our head. But until that day occurs, that is one of the most critical, essential capabilities. And then to tell that story well. Now, how, like, you've gone into this space, been very successful in this space. Sort of, I call it democratizing cultural philosophy. And like all of our guests have that in common. They're people who are democratizing access to law, democratizing access to journalism, democratizing access. If you're Eric Hunley, unstructured podcast, you're democratizing access to things like various forms of behavior, language, body language, understanding mental forensics, et cetera. And what you're doing is democratizing cultural philosophy to a wide spectrum. Oh, you know, great guests throughout your show and your series that people can find on YouTube. You know, what one led you to go into that space? You're a very good narrator. Like we had Count Dankula on yesterday, and he tells, and the key to a great joke, like Scott Adams does as well, is being able to tell a story. Yeah. And he tells stories so funny that I still remember him, and I'm going to be retelling the jokes exactly as he told them because he framed it so perfectly.
Yeah.
What led to your capacity to be a good narrator, and what led to your interest in this wide into democratizing cultural philosophy for the masses, for removing the monopolistic means of production in the media space that the institutionalists have had for too long?
Okay. First of all, so much there. First of all, I want to address the comment that you posted up there. Jack is not a victim. He's successful. You know what, lady or whomever? Just because I was able to recover from having my life destroyed by malicious actors and I didn't end up eating a shotgun, which I thought about. Imagine 40 years of your life evaporated in an instant. Your college degree, your graduate degree, your entire resume, your status and reputation, your ability to earn money, your ability to provide for your children, to feed your kids, to house your kids, to clothe your children, gone by lies. How is that not being a victim? Now, I don't have a victim mindset. I didn't let it get me down. I mean, man, it was dark. 18 months, I'd say. Dark.
You know what, actually, and Jack, I just want to add something to that also, because this was Justine Sacco. I always go back to this book, but the people who survived the public shamings, and you know, they get a job 2 years later, and then people say, oh, well, they got it. Look at that. Justine Sacco's got a job at the same PR firm that fired her 2 years earlier. They never suffer. People don't understand the type of suffering that can be imposed in the digital world because they think it's all just, you know, ones and zeros in a matrix and it doesn't affect a real person. And so nobody really fully understands what it does, even if you are able to survive from it. And that is if you don't go off the deep end, like a number of people have done because of the public shamings, because of the destruction, because
we don't even hear about those guys. There's a story about a guy who did something stupid. Someone posted it to YouTube. His name is the first thing on his name. He couldn't get a job and they found him dead in his car. He killed himself. The kids hadn't seen him for weeks. They don't talk about those stories. So I got a little hot just from that.
That was the second thing is how, you know, I'm saying this without judgment because it's the natural tendency is people are going to say you're angry and you come off as angry. And, you know, listening to the book, I can see the elements of anger in this is that you're angry from the experience and they can write you off because of it. They say, oh, he's an angry white man who got divorced. Welcome to the club. And then write you off because of your anger. Without fully appreciating that might be at the very least everyone else's reaction having gone through the similar thing. I mean, how do you respond to being written off as just an angry man? Get over it.
Well, first of all, you should have finished the book, bro, because there's only one chapter about the divorce. There's a whole rest of the book where I give the structural and philosophical analysis of why all these things happen.
I wanted to set that up for those who know part of the story. I listen to the thing.
Okay. Second of all, damn right I'm angry. You know why? Because this is bull. All of it is bull. And if we don't start getting angry and start taking action, there's going to be nothing to conserve. I am sick and tired of people sitting around saying that we need to be polite and we need to have our norms and we need to be respectful. And man, F that. James Lindsay is the king of that right now, of busting that norm. And I 100% support his entire shift on Twitter that people are complaining about. I think he's 100% accurate. We need to break free of these outside constraints of pseudo morality where I'm not allowed to be mad because I've been aggrieved. That's stupid.
It's very much like Jerry Spitz. He used to say the gentleman's rules of the bar are so that the gentleman can rule the bar. And that at times you need to break the gentleman's rules in order to remove the gentleman from controlling the bar. And he means the gentleman in the top hat way, the old upper caste way. I actually had a great therapist once say that one of the great myths, she was not a woke therapist, but she pointed out that we're kind of taught. Now, some of this is British American culture, like our mutual acquaintance, Paul Watson, as all it's aside from his public personality. He has that sort of diplomatic, you know, the won't take credit that much for things that he's actually helped meaningfully accomplish, that sort of British humility. And almost in the American, particularly for young boys and men, we're taught not to be angry, that anger is bad, that anger is something wrong. It was actually this woman counselor who said anger is one of the most important emotions you need to experience and listen to, because they're often your instinct screaming to you that something is wrong. Yes. And she pointed out in this particular relationship I'd been in, she said, what would have happened if you would have listened to that anger? And I'm like, I would have been out of there a lot sooner and saved myself a lot of problems. But anger is not such a bad thing, I think. But there's something in the Western, and this is a good bridge to the broader conversation, that you're one of the leaders, is part of the reason for the liminal order, part of the reason for a large part of your conversations, the 21 conference speeches that you've given. Is there really is, and I think if you have a son, it's going to be accentuated extraordinarily so. The assault on men, yes. I mean, now we have an additional attack on biological gender, but before we get to that, can you talk about, I mean, there is just a cultural, political, social onslaught against men. And one of it is, if you're a man, you're not allowed to be angry. Or if you are angry, we get to discredit you. We get to say you no longer have validity. When in fact, being angry is, as that counselor told me, one of the most important, legitimate ways we can understand and get access to truth. But can you talk about that in the broader context of just what an onslaught and assault on men is taking place as merely the idea of masculinity in our society today?
You're absolutely right. And look, there's a difference between rage and anger, right? I have righteous anger. I have been wronged, and I am not going to accept that. And that is okay. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Blind rage, where you don't have control of yourself and you've lost your capacity for critical thinking and self, you know, restraint, that's bad. That's toxic. Which
basically describes the woke left.
Right, exactly. And so, yes, in the context of the greater war, look, this whole thing is about destroying masculinity. It all comes all the way back down to that. Why? All societies have been oppressive. This is the argument. All societies have been oppressive. All societies have been patriarchal. Patriarchy is oppressive. The power of the patriarchy comes from men. What is male power? Masculine energy. If we're going to save the world from oppression, we have to end the patriarchy. Therefore, we have to end male power and destroy masculine energy. It's not, I'm not speculating, guys. This is in the literature. Okay. Like, I'm not making it up. It's in the books. This is what they say. It's very clear. It's black and white. It is why queering is a thing. Queering is a verb. Queering means to destroy boundaries so that we don't have distinctions between us, between other groups, between individuals, so that we all become the same thing, which means we all become nothing. Right. Queering is to destroy masculinity. It's even to destroy femininity. It's to destroy the family. It's to destroy countries. It's to destroy nations. Queering is all part of this attack on masculinity. And everything that the progressives do, the Black Lives Matter, the CRT folks, the rad femmes, all of it comes all the way back down, all the way down the drain, all the way back to this war on men. And the war on men is real, and it's been ongoing. And not only is there a war on men, but there is the continued advancement of female interests. But let me tell you some stats. Girls do better in elementary school than boys. Girls do better in middle school than boys. Girls do better in high school than boys. They graduate high school at a higher rate. They apply to college at a higher rate. They're accepted to college at a higher rate. They graduate college at a higher rate. In 148 out of 150 metropolitan cities in America, they earn more than their male counterparts at entry-level jobs. Over their careers, they have more managerial and professional positions than men. Over their life, they are less likely to succumb to alcoholism, drug addiction, suicide. And at the end of the day, they live longer, and when they die, they control more wealth than men. Where in that is there any sign of female oppression? But yet, today, everything is about, oh, we're going to have to hire 15% of our pilots have to be women now. Why? What if women don't want to be pilots? Goodness. All of this is a battle to destroy masculine energy, which is why the manosphere got attacked. What is wrong with guys getting together to share their experiences and to gather strength from their friendships? Why? What's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that except that it allows men to see underneath or behind the cloak, right? Behind the curtain a little bit. But everything or anything, Boy Scouts, another great example, anything that is about men coming together to make themselves better men, to increase their masculine energy, to increase their brotherhood is a threat. Black Lives Matter says all black suffering is the result of white systems of oppression. Feminists say the same thing. All female suffering is the result of male systems of oppression. What's animating these male systems of oppression but male energy? This is logical. It's logical to make this argument. It's also in the literature. I'm not making anything up. And it's time that people actually are aware. It's astounding to me that people aren't, that you say that. And they're like, oh, well, but there's still more male CEOs. Guess what? Women don't want to be CEOs. Why? I don't want to be CEO of a corporation either. That sounds horrible. I don't want to be president either. Anyway, I'm getting hot. The James Damore memo from Google.
Yeah, you talked about that in the book as well.
Oh, you did make it at least halfway.
No, I mean,
I'm just kidding, dude. Just kidding.
And most, because most people don't know the full story of James Damore. Like, most people think it was an unsolicited opinion email that he sent around, and they don't realize that it was actually a question that he was asked to prepare a response for, and the response was weaponized in a way to sully his name in a way that once the accusation is made, that's all that was needed to end his career and Lord knows what he's doing, but yeah, go on with it, please.
Yeah. So James Damore went to a, diversity, equity, inclusion thing at Google, where at Google, they're like, oh, you know, we don't have enough women working here. Never mind that not as many women are applying. Never mind that when you can sign, you know, that cartoon, that meme where it's like STEM class sign up here and the like women's studies sign up over here and the line for the women's studies around the corner. The point is that when James Damore responded to a request for feedback, he just listed a bunch of data. Women have different personalities. Women are inclined to do different things. Men are inclined to do different things. Hey, in the Scandinavian countries where they're the most egalitarian in the world, the difference, the polarization in professional choice is even more pronounced than it is here in the United States because they have the choice. Right? Women, men like to build, create, provide, protect. Women like to nurture and to care and to love and to tend. It's built into us. The James Damore memo, he brought that stuff to light. Then he got fired for it. And then the follow-up stuff, the investigative journalism and the lawsuits that came out of that revealed so much about the inner workings of Google. Their philosophies, the way that they have adopted all of these things that we're talking about, the negative elements. And then not only that, but they have now baked it into the technology. It's baked into the algorithms. It's baked into your search results. So these philosophies that all men need to go away, otherwise we're going to have oppressive patriarchies forever, is built into the technology that controls access basically to all the world's information. Now, if that's not a red-pilling moment that makes you be like, oh, damn, it makes you wonder maybe should the government get involved a little bit? I don't know what else is gonna. And so you can see now how like me getting divorced, wanting to date, start pulling on this thread, it's the same thread. It's the same thread. It just led all the way to the Google search results and the monopolization of data and information.
And it's an interesting thing because, I mean, I've noticed it as well, whether or not it's an attack on masculinity or just on traditional values in quotes. So we might actually be saying the same thing, but just using different words. I have nephews who are going to university now, and I'm saying university is not a place where I would want to go. It's not a place where I would want to be. It's not an environment that I would want to be in. And it was already getting a little towards that end when I was in university, where you couldn't, you know, unless you hated the United States, this was back, what year are we in? 2004. Unless you hated the United States, you know, you would face the same wrath, but to a much lesser degree than what we see today on a slew of broader issues. I wouldn't want to be a male who you know, it is an actual liability to be, you know, unsupervised with members of the opposite sex because of what the power in the accusation, the power of the victimhood now. So I'm seeing it as well as, you know, maybe to a lesser degree because I haven't lived it. But I guess now, so
keep listening, bro.
You know, now the question is, I know what you're doing to counter it. So does this work its way into the essence of what the liminal group is? First of all, what does the word liminal mean? I didn't get to look that up.
So Liminal Order is the name of our organization. And liminality is the state of being between two fixed points. It is a transition period. Oftentimes, you know, it's used to describe like the transition from boyhood into manhood. Or Indians and Native Americans would do vision quests where they would go out and break down their reality and then reconsolidate it into a new one. Liminality is just a state of being in which that there is an additional element of chaos and there's additional elements of uncertainty. And it is where we are right now, right? We're in a position of change, of dramatic change. And we're sort of adrift because these traditional values, to use Nassim Taleb's word, the Lindy values of masculinity and femininity. What could be more Lindy than masculinity and femininity, by the way? The values in this whole, our whole culture is in a moment of transition and change, and order is what you want to do when you've got chaos. You want to bring order to chaos. And then it's a little bit of a pun. It's an order of men. So the liminal order, it is for our men. We're understanding we're in this transition period. There's increased chaos in our society. And here we are, an order of men attempting to bring order to chaos. And so, yes, our common values, this is a values-based organization, masculinity and brotherhood. You combine those two and you get sovereignty. Okay. That's what we're all about. We're all about enhancing and strengthening our sense of masculine energy within ourselves and our membership, brotherhood, and then also manifesting more of them in the world around us with the intent and goal of leading to personal and physical sovereignty. This is our goal. This is our response to the war on men. This is our response to the attack on masculinity. This is our response to the chaos and the mayhem that is out there and the destruction and capture of all of our institutions. And this is our response. It's one piece. There has to be a million things to happen.
What does personal and physical sovereignty mean concretely?
Concretely, well, each of the values have sub-values. Masculinity, mastery, honor, courage, loyalty. We are builders, protectors, providers, instructors, right? Brotherhood, service to each other, service to the community, loyalty to each other, community, right? Then sovereignty. So personal sovereignty. This is a notion that I got from Jordan Greenhall, AKA. And in personal sovereignty is about maintaining your narrative space, maintaining your personal narrative, not becoming a victim of ideologies inserted into your brain. Jordan Peterson says frequently, or did previously, that people don't have ideas. Ideas have people. Okay. We are not going to be that guy. We are not going to be the guy who an idea captured. Okay. And if you just listen to conventional wisdom today, here's what happens. You go to college, you take on a bunch of debt, you get chained to a corporate desk, you become fat if you listen to the government and the food pyramid. And then right now you're in your basement wearing two masks with your kid quarantined in the room next to you because somebody at the school got corona a month ago, especially if you're in Canada, right? Okay. So that's what happens when you just accept the narratives, the conventional wisdom you put in your brain. It kills you. Okay. It makes you sick and fat and change you to your desk, and it's slavery. We have elected to be personally sovereign in the sense that we will occupy our own brains, and you have to actively occupy it with your own intentional narrative and then defend that space from outside invading narratives. And if it sounds a little crazy, maybe, but like in our age of narrative and social media, people are trying to inject ideas into your brain. We all know someone who 10 years ago was totally normal, totally fine, great values. We got along. You could work with them, live with them. Hell, you could have married them. 10 years later today, they're insane. They are insane with critical race theory, Black Lives Matter, the whole thing. See race and racism everywhere. Say, hey, it's cool. Burn down these cities. Who cares? They're insane. Why? Because they didn't actively defend their mind space. They weren't critical of the narratives that were inserted into their brains. And now it's leading them astray. And so that's what personal sovereignty is for us. And let me just finish. That's made up of seven things. And this is what, I mean, we actively work on this. We workshop this. We study it. We have classes. We have programs. It starts with integrity, physical, mental, spiritual, emotional integrity. And I don't mean doing the right thing. I mean like the strength and structure and then integrated into a whole. Physical starts with the squat rack. Every one of our members has to work towards and achieve physical fitness standards. We all encourage everyone to be spiritual. We study cognitive behavioral therapy so that we can control our emotions. We work on our skills of discernment, of embodiment, of choice and making commitment, and of sense making. And again, the goal here is to embody your values. Personal sovereignty. That's what we're all about.
Well, I think
go ahead, Robert.
The key to self-empowerment, the first step is self-education, which is what the liminal order prioritizes out of the gate. And I often have had this conversation because, like, people say there's this tendency. There was even, frankly, a weakness in Trumpism in part that was to delegate power that allowed the QAnon phenomenon to even exist.
Yes.
It said you don't have the power. Only this guy does. And so your goal is just to forfeit your own self-education, self-information, and give it to this person because he's the only solution. And a lot of people that are locked up related to January 6th convinced themselves that only Trump could save them, but that they could not save themselves in an independent way. And can you talk, like, the whole reason why we created our locals board, vivabarneslaw.locals.com.
You're getting it, Robert.
is because the first step of self, and I like, I've been following Jack for a long time, known him for many years. Great guy. I loved what you were doing in the liminal order, because what I've tried to tell people who are saying, well, you know, sometimes they want Viva to sue. They want me to bring like every lawsuit. I bring as many as I can, one guy. But I keep telling them the first big step is you. Self-empowerment. It starts with self-education. And you change the world individually, and you don't understand how significant and consequential that is. The system understands that. The wokesters understand that. Gramsci understood that when he talked about the slow march through institutions. And we're seeing the outcome of it today because some 1970s community college professor understood it when he started preaching it, started teaching it to where now it's in your local public school in a small town in Tennessee. Could you tell me what led you to understand how important? I mean, you followed up with concrete action creating the liminal order, but can you explain why self-education is such a critical step to meaningful self-empowerment?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Our mutual friend, Mike Cernovich, he became very popular because he started writing about mindset, right? What's mindset? Mindset is the ability to use self-talk to control your frame, to control your own narrative. And so Mike was actually one of the first people to turn me on to this idea of really active. And, you know, you mentioned one of his big influences too earlier. Do you know who I'm going to say? Jerry Spence, right? Narrative, man. It's all about the story. You got to tell the story. It's always about the story, 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 and the right kind of storytelling, right? But Mike turned me on to mindset. Mike turned me on to the idea of being able to control your thoughts, control your emotions, not to not have emotions, not to disregard your emotions. No. If you are an in-tune person, you should really listen to your emotions. That's your pre-language body telling you something. And by the way, everybody, our pre-language body is way older than our language body, right? It got us here. These instincts, the senses that we have. Pay attention to your emotions after you've confirmed that they're not telling you a lie, right? So anyway, I'm going to go back now to the question that you asked me like five questions ago that we never got to, because it's closing the loop here. I am a naturally curious person, and that is exactly how I got to this point. I want to know why. I want to know why, and I want to know now. And I'm willing to put in the time and the effort and the energy to figure it out. That's why I started my podcast. My podcast is entirely this idea that I wanted, I read this great book. man, wouldn't it be great to talk to the author for 2 or 3 hours about it? And that's just been the animating force all the way through. And so in this environment today where our institutions are corrupted, every institution that used to help us, save you, teach you, help give you meaning, all of them are corrupted and captured. Period. Gone. You must take on the responsibility of becoming an autodidact. My son is 14. And the other day he told me, I did not know this, he told me that he wrote an essay in class saying that going to college was stupid. And I was like, oh gosh. I mean, I know I've been telling you that. I know we've been talking about it, but you wrote a paper in class and you presented it. And he's like, yeah, man. And I didn't feel anything weird about it. Everyone in the class was like, how could you say that? Because of course they're all beaten over the head every single day. This is Bethesda, Maryland, right? It's all of them sons and daughters of lawyers and diplomats, right? They all think that the only choice in the whole universe is to go to college. But what I told my son just the other night was like, look, you may not have to go to college today, but that doesn't mean you don't have to learn. You must learn. You must teach yourself. You must find mentors. You must find other teachers. And the way that this world is evolving, for example, is the best college professors are doing bespoke, customized, individualized coursework now. I took a course this spring called Applied Complexity with Joe Norman. Joe Norman is a applied complexity scientist. He wrote a paper with Nassim Taleb in January of 2020 that led to the shutdown of international flights that probably saved a lot of lives when it came to Corona. He's not teaching in university. He's teaching private classes. I took a philosophy class with Michael Millerman, world-leading philosopher. May not have a contemporary equal in some subject areas. And he offers private education. You can get a combination of free courses out there and private, bespoke, custom assembled for yourself education. And you must continuously educate yourself. There is no way that you can sit back and just absorb and think that you're going to come out ahead. Because if you just absorb what they tell you, you're going to be fat, sick, and chained to a desk in debt with your kids locked up in the basement, especially if you're in Canada.
Okay, but Jack, so here's my question. First of all, Courtney, I forgot her last name already. Courtney wants to know if you're going to open a liminal program for women. And it's sort of in the same vein of a question. I like the clarification or the specificity you're giving. This sounds like, you know, a lot like Jordan Peterson's 12 rules. It sounds like a very good lessons for anybody to learn. And I suspect they can get all these same principles on your podcast, regardless of whether or not they're members of the liminal order by virtue of them not being men. The question is this. My immediate fear and reflex always goes to people getting the wrong impression of when you say fight for a call to action, et cetera, et cetera. What's the assurance? What is the underlying principle that this is all done in a manner that, you know, in the lawful manner that nobody takes the wrong message from this? When you say call to action, defend what it means to defend the values that are near and dear to you.
All right. First of all, no, I will never start a women's liminal order. Why? The values are masculinity and brotherhood. Two, there's not a women's liminal order. You know why? No offense. That's just not how women work. Where, why not? Build it. Go for it. 100%. Go build it. The liminal order is a manifestation of masculine energy. We built, we provide, we protect, we instruct, we master. This is just our energy, and it's manifested inside the liminal order. Now, I want to push back on your question. Why do I have to tell you that I'm not going to do something illegal and terrible? Why is that your assumption, friend?
Well, it's not an assumption. And this is
no, it was baked into the question.
No, and admittedly, it is. It's something that I struggle with. It's something where when you have people following you, and one uses rhetoric that could be influencing to some but inciting to others, the question is, you know, whether or not you feel any responsibility for people who are following you strictly, who might get the wrong impression.
Sure.
Or you know, just bottom line. If it's, I suspect it is baked into the principles itself that, you know, you do this and you fight for things lawfully. Otherwise, you just become the monster that you're battling. And I mean, that's the fine line. Now, I do agree. In social media, especially in social media, the tendency is to say you're guilty of all the comments of your subs and your followers, and look who watches you, look who's commenting. Therefore, you must be doing something wrong if you're attracting a crowd that says certain things. And I don't believe in guilt by association. The only question is when you use, I won't say inflammatory rhetoric, but emotional rhetoric because you're emotional and you want to get the point across, where do you feel the responsibility or weigh the words to make sure that nobody gets the wrong impression?
I understand where you're getting at. You're fishing, though. I've never said anything inflammatory, call to action that was anything illegal. I know. That was anything illegal. So we've been very clear from the beginning. A, we're not the effing Proud Boys, and we never will be. Okay. B, we'll never make any public display of force. We don't go to protests. We don't fly flags. We don't provide security for people. We're not a militia. We're not any of that stuff. Clear as day, written in the literature. And if you follow me on Twitter, you know that I am vehement about that. And I shame and shun all that other stuff. We are Gandhi, bro. We are Be the Change. We're being the change we want to see in the world today. We are starting with ourselves. And we're taking care of our family. We're taking care of our community. And for those of us inside the Liminal Order that can do that, and then some of us are trying to take care of the nation as well. And all I'm doing is providing a venue by which men can commune together to take the benefit of community. Science shows very clearly that community makes you happier, healthier, and wealthier. Yeah. And you see it all through history.
And in that capacity, so, I mean, you've done a good job of creating a liminal order that focuses on its truest objectives, that avoids some of the pitfalls that some of us had warned oath keepers of risk if certain things went a certain way. The people that do American contingency have tried to make sure they don't get caught up in that. But they've been, but it's difficult. If you don't create the rules that you create. And of course, it's a liminal order. You got to have some rules. But if you don't create those rules, some of us told Gavin this was going to be a problem 4 years ago of how Proud Boys was going to be attacked. And he seemed a little strangely naive for Gavin McInnes, for those people who don't know. It's who Antifa dreams about. And this is probably a good bridge. You've done a lot of grassroots street journalistic coverage of Antifa, the DC protests, the insanity that took place. I remember we talked about it last year. Yeah. Could you go into some of the – congratulations to making sure liminal order cannot be misused or miscaricatured by the press and the public by creating these – and it's advice for those people who want to create comparable organizations. Look at what Jack has done to avoid the problems that Oath Keepers have run into, that Proud Boys ultimately ran into, so on and so forth. Could you talk about your Antifa grassroots, right, witnessing the insanity – of like 1968 come back, but with less justification than 1968.
Man, last summer was crazy, dude. And it's looking like it's going to be about the same thing. I mean, Minneapolis is about ready. It's a tinderbox. And if you've been keeping up with the case, I mean, all I know is I got a shadow of a doubt. I mean, maybe someone else on the jury will. All it takes is one, right? So what happened this last summer, in May when the Floyd stuff kicked off, I just went downtown to see what was happening in my city. And I ended up in the middle of a freaking riot filled with arson and assaults and property destruction. I watched people try to burn down buildings. I watched buildings go up in smoke. And when I say watched, I mean, I'm like, people are throwing rocks over my head at buildings. I'm getting literally get shot by rubber bullets from the riot police. Right on live stream. Luckily, I had a big mask on, man, my beard, but the bullet went right here and it hit me right in the throat. Luckily, it had gone through my beard and my mask and everything, but it was on live stream. Oh, it knocked me down on the ground. It was pretty funny. But I never once said, hey, guys from the LO, come down here and support me. Hey, let's go down there and make a scene. Hey, let's go hold some territory. Hey, let's go storm this building. No, that's stupid, man. That's stupid. We're deliberately trying to get out of the limelight, out of the spotlight. That is why we've built a completely separate and secure communications network. There's no way that there's no chance that Google or YouTube or Twitter or anybody can interfere with any of that. And I am the avatar. I am the representative. I'm the one that goes out in public. Have you ever seen anybody on Twitter saying I'm a member of the Liminal Order? Nope. And we have 500 guys, and they're all active on social media. And you know, a lot of them, Craig, And no one ever talks about it. I am the one that out here to take the lightning, to take the heat. I go down into the riots. I show the world what's happening with, you know, no action, no activism. What am I going to do? I'm one man. I got assaulted. I got attacked. I got surrounded by 30 people at one point. It was me and like 30 people, and they had me cornered, and I just kept backing up and backing up and backing up, and I got backed up right into the police line. I didn't even know it, and I got a boom. I got like a riot shield in my back, and it's just me with all these people. And right before it just went, one of the cops like reached through and grabbed me by the belt and just yanked me back. And like all of a sudden, I was like, whoa, I was about ready to get assaulted by 30 people. And now I'm like behind the riot wall. So like I've been in the middle. I've seen it all. This is not speculation on my part. I have been there with the tear glass. I've had flashbangs go off right over my head. I've stood there while hordes of people destroyed buildings, looted. I was standing 10 feet away from people just looting stores and setting buildings on fire. So when I talk about the riots, I am not speculating and I'm not looking at any other news source. I'm not reading an article and saying this is what happened. I was there. And in fact, my reporting was one of the most and only honest reporting of the events that went on in DC because none of it was picked up. None of it. And even my friends, my local friends, they had no idea. And people were like, oh, the Proud Boys are going to come. They're going to destroy the city. I'm like, hello? All of the buildings are boarded up because Black Lives Matter has been blowing up the city for 3 months. And they're like, oh, that's not right. That's not right. I'm like, no, but I was there. And they're like, no, you weren't. So people have an inability to process facts that go counter to their narrative, right? That's a great example. I know this one guy, entrepreneur, owns a huge company, made a ton of money, great guy, Army Ranger, marathon runner, you know, all these things you would think he'd be totally like, you know, sane. He's too busy working. He reads the news. He gets the narrative. All of a sudden, it's just the Proud Boys and white supremacists that have been blowing up the city for 6 months. He doesn't have the time or energy to fight it. And so then I say that, and he's like, no, you're wrong. And then blocks me on Facebook, you know? So like that's what happens. It's like you present facts to people and then it just doesn't jive with the narrative because their ego invested in the narrative because they decided I'm going to accept this narrative subconsciously and now they're attached to it. So they have to defend it, even if they don't even know if it's true or not.
It's the Mark Twain, easier to fool people than it is to convince them they've been fooled. And you know, one thing I did like from the book was the, you know, the specific attempts to dissociate yourself from Spencer. What's his first name?
Richard Spencer.
So now, incidentally, I know nothing of Richard Spencer except for what I've heard other people say. I know nothing, but I know what they say. And you know, so in the book, you're saying like we're going out of our way to show what we are not in an attempt to show what we are, which is principled and tolerant, but tolerant in our principles. So
I have forgotten about that whole story. So much has happened since then. Even that is the irony. I don't even know if this is what that word means anymore. That's the weird coinky dink weirdness about what happened with that event about me getting doxxed. You know why? Because they used a picture where I happened to have been in the same location as Richard Spencer. And they're like, cause I was just covering an Antifa alt-right confrontation after the Syrian missile strikes in the first year of Trump's presidency. And someone took a picture, a friend of mine took a picture. I had posted it to Facebook. And then they use that to say, I'm an associate of Richard Spencer. Okay. Now let's go back to the deplorable. Okay. January, 2017, Richard Spencer was banned from the deplorable. Why? Because Mike Cernovich and Jack Posobiec and Jeff Giese and the other people who were involved in planning it, they didn't want anything to do with that guy. We didn't want anything to do with that guy. He comes to the after party unannounced, and it was late, and we were partying, and I was like, what the F are you doing here? Get out of here. Get out of here. Get out of here. And like we just kind of went at it, and like we were about ready to go. Like it was on. It was go time. And then, boom, everybody jumped in, and that was the end of it. So the fact that they tried to paint me as an alt-right Nazi, even though I had literally gone out of my way, I've written articles about it, written essays about it, all of my associates pushed them away, shunned them away, it still didn't matter. The accusation, despite concrete evidence documented in the news, it was written about by The Atlantic, The New Yorker, and stupid-ass Oliver Darcy from Business Insider at the time. Mm-hmm. They all wrote about it. And it was on the internet, And it still didn't matter. So narrative and accusations rule over fact and research anytime. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, don't worry. Now, you said we only had about 60 to 90 minutes. We've already gone over
that.
We're
going, bro. Let's go.
Okay, so here's the question now. You were, I listened to the book in the joy of when Trump had been elected and was still president. What now, and what's the level of despair, desperation, or optimism seeing what's happening to Title IX, seeing the new administration, and seeing where things are going?
Look, Trump was the best thing at the time. Does that mean he was a good thing? I don't know. Does that mean he was good at his job? I don't know. Did he screw up a hell of a lot? Yes. Was he a coward in a lot of cases? Yes. Was he an ineffective manager and a terrible hire and a terrible institution builder? Yes. Was he like a terrible politician and bureaucrat? Yes. Was he what we needed at that time? Yes. Right? I mean, all these things can be true. And he can be a disappointment. I still, like, I'm definitely disappointed with a lot. He fired people that I'm friends with that he never should have fired. He backed down from the mob. He gave in so many times. He didn't hire the right people. He didn't respect them, and he didn't have those people's back. That's the part that burns me up the most about all of it, is the way that he hung loyal, loyal, dedicated people. He hung them out to dry like a bitch. I hated that. Now, did we need that? Yes, we needed him in 2016. If Hillary Clinton would have gotten elected, all the things I wrote about in the book would have been 10 times worse. All the stuff we're dealing with now would have happened in 2016. It would have been farther along. He was a weapon that failed to detonate. Man, he was a bomb we dropped on the city that didn't explode. What a disappointment in that regard. Would I do it all over again? Hell yeah, I would. I mean, look, remember the choices. The choice was Trump or Hillary Clinton, right? It's the same thing. Trump or Biden, of course, it's silly. That's a no question, right? Because he may be incompetent and he may have screwed up and he may have let the people I know and respect hang out, hang him out to dry. But, you know, those were the choices and that's what we did, and we would do it again. He also awoke. He woke up American nationalism. And I think that that is a good thing. I think that's a good thing. We need something to unite us as a nation. And if we don't have it, if we don't have a race, remember, we were 90% white up until 1965. If we don't have a race to unite us, like, you know, European countries and other countries around the world, common blood and heritage and history, if we don't have that, then we have to at least have nationalism, a civic nationalism of some kind. Because if we don't have that, then why the hell are we all here? We're all just here just to get our thing and screw everybody else. Because what would unite us? Blood, race, ideology, nationalism, patriotism? I don't know. He awoke an American nationalism and an American, I think, spirituality in the heartland, a reawakening of American spirituality, as ironic as that is for Donald Trump. But which was a benefit. It was a good thing. And I hope that we can continue to build on that energy. And he certainly red-pilled a bunch of people. And we've seen, there you go. He red-pilled Americans on the reality of the deep state, no doubt. He also red-pilled Americans, a lot of them, on the media, right? And, he also helped influence some, think tanks and organizations out there to be a little bit more aware of some of the more pertinent issues. You know, Claremont comes to mind. Was it a net benefit? I mean, I would do it again, 100%. I don't want him to run in 2024. I want someone else. I want Trump 2.0, the guy that understands you have to build institutions, you have to staff the bureaucracy. Because those are the people that are going to be there after you leave. When Obama came to town in 2008 in D.C., prior to that, it was cowboy hats and steakhouses in D.C., okay? Because the Bush and Texas people, they took over the town. As soon as Obama got here, steakhouses closed, cowboy hats were gone, millions of people poured into the city. They populated all the NGOs, they populated all the group houses and the staffers, and they never left, man. Obama transformed Washington, D.C. because he was smart in this regard about institution building. Trump destroyed institutions, didn't build a single thing. The tenor and the tone of the town didn't change at all. There was no cultural shift that would have been evident by the mass of people that he should have brought into the city to take over or to even build institute, you know, think tanks or other just of the satellite institutions that should go around a political movement. He didn't do any of that. He didn't lead anyone there. And that's because he was flawed, right? Because people hate him, because there's so many things about him that you could point to and be like, that's not good.
Well, despite his life being a builder, he is politically a burner. Yeah. Now, his great skill is to clear the landscape. His great skill was not to build the new building and to build the new infrastructure. Yeah. And while maybe he could adjust late in life, that was improbable. And we witnessed 4 years where that wasn't going to be his strong point or his strength. I've told people, if you want the next, you want Trumpism to succeed, you want the next version of Trump to be made real in the institutions of power, you know, with the historical template, Andrew Jackson, 1824, he loses. Other people came along to Jackson and pitched to him, here's how you build the infrastructure to make this last. And they built a political party that's still around today. I mean, the Democratic Party started because people around Andrew Jackson decided to institutionalize the Jacksonian revolt that led to the working man's parties of the 1830s and 1840s. And arguably, I mean, with obviously the notable exception of slavery, otherwise, it was the most economically democratized, culturally democratic society in the world, at least compared to the whole West. So he helped create that. And then there's the William Jennings Bryan example of somebody who just was a great speaker and it never became anything. It never translated. If anything, he did damage to it because he never transitioned into it. I tell him, if you want Trumpism, you know, read Gramsci. You know, even though he's talking about something different, that slow walk through the institutions, that's why we have laws on the books and big corporations saying men are women. You know, I mean, right now. I mean, this is an idea 5 years ago. People would have, it was still in the DSM-5. You know, I mean, that whole mindset. But the other credit I'll give Trump is he sort of validated masculinity to a certain degree. Yes. And he was sort of the beginning of this masculine pushback against the assault on men. He was unafraid. He also stylistically introduced a critical component that you talk about, which is the time for politeness, the time for curtsying to the people in power is over. And the very means of resistance in order to be successful for their ends must change in accord with that. And Trump blazed the path on that. So credit to him in that respect.
100%. 100%. And one of the main themes in the book is Trump as a masculine avatar for the pushback against the feminine, you know, overreach. And I kept using that phrase in the book, feminist overreach. I would like to, I want to make that much more severe now, you know, the feminist revolution, takeover, destruction of society, you know, the maniacal destruction of our universe.
I mean, this is the criticism you're going to face, is because when you criticize feminism in its form today, it lends to the idea that you think all problems are solved, or that there is nothing that requires what feminism was anymore, no problems to remedy. And you're gonna irk people, especially when they conflate current day, if you want to call it feminism, which seems to be trampling on women's rights, which is the irony, versus, you know, back in the day feminism. I think I don't give
two flying F's about those people. Those people are stuck with their heads up their ass, and they are trying to be victims, and they're worried about things that aren't real. I laid out all the facts around female circumstances, female empowerment, female earning, female health, female wealth. Women live longer, healthier. They're better educated. They make more money and they're less sick. Like, there's nothing that a woman can't do today. In fact, we have charity programs for women called the U.S. Women's Soccer Team, right? Because if we didn't have a women's soccer team, there would be no women playing soccer. We've constructed an entire framework to make it so that the slower, weaker, you know, species, gender, can have an opportunity to perform. Okay. So like everything that we do is to boost them. So if anybody wants to tell me that there is one circumstance of female oppression in America today, that's somebody I don't even need to talk to. Okay. And when you say that I'm going to be criticized by those people, bro, I could care less. My job now is not about convincing people. I'm collecting a tribe. Okay. I'm not trying to change anyone's mind out there. I'm trying to give people a framework that jives with their experience and their instincts, and collect those people into a force. You're not going to convince someone whose entire identity is based around the idea that women are oppressed in America. It's just insane.
Now, part of that, when you talk about building a force to sort of reconstruct people's own understanding of themselves and the world around them to be able to make meaningful change in their own communities and then in the larger community, is you've talked about getting back to sort of basic skills, basic capabilities. I think it's wood carpentry, I think, is the latest thing you mentioned. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, man. As a masculine energy is to build. Sovereignty is to be able to build, is to be able to live off the land, is to be able to live off the economic landscape, is to be able to just take care of yourself. And I have a vision for myself, and I'm making progress towards it. I will have acreage in the mountains. I'm making my way to there, and I will know how to, and I already do, but I will master this, fell a tree, mill a tree into lumber, and build the house that I want, right? And in the liminal order, we are building the builders. And we mean that in every capacity, whether it's sense making, whether it's actually carpentry, we have master carpenter teaching guys how to do it, whether it's financial sovereignty, whether it's info mining. I've made this comparison today. The homesteader learns how to live off the land. They are resourceful. You can drop them anywhere. They're not going to starve. They're not going to freeze. They're not going to get eaten by an animal. And they can have a very nice life, okay? Today, what we need is info homesteading, okay? If you want to be an independent person in this world with ideas that don't jive up with the Leviathan, you're going to have to figure out how to make money outside of the system. You have to learn how to make money by mining the information hills. There is still gold out there in the info landscape. Learn how to be an info homesteader. Make your money in the information space. There's ways to do it. This is still the first inning of the internet. Even though it seems like the big players are all in place, I promise you guys, things are going to change still, right? Well, there's a lot of evolution to go here.
The amazing thing is, you know, agree or disagree with you, it is the one common theme among the survivors of public shaming is you survive when you don't care. When you stick to your beliefs, whether or not people go after you the way they have. And it's interesting. Not everyone has the courage to do it, but not everyone has had the experience that brought them to where you are. And I'm also realizing that this is out of Fight Club. You know, I wanted to build a house when they're in the car going down the street and he lets go of the steering wheel. And you're also Jack, which is Jack's total lack of surprise. So this is two coincidences from Fight Club. We'll wind it down, but what's your next plan? Where are you going with this? And what are your aspirations for the future?
Well, I have personal aspirations for the future to continue to enhance my own physical and personal sovereignty, build the homestead, build the compound. That's coming. We're already making good progress on that. For the liminal order, we expect to expand. We have about 6,000 people on our email list right now. We let in about 50 guys a month. Every month it fills up. We just finished a 2-day, sort of opening. We plan to grow that to a couple thousand people here in the United States over the next 12 to 18 months. Then we plan to expand internationally. There are hundreds of millions of people around the world feeling exactly the same way we're feeling. Hey, man, you know this better than anybody. You think we got it bad in the United States? Try going to Canada.
No, I wouldn't.
Try going to England, right? It is worse. It is worse.
Count Dankula served time. He told the funny story. Right. You know, he's sitting around the jail cell and everybody's in there for all these hardcore things. And he looks like a tough guy. And he's like, I made a video. And they're like, yeah, you're lying. You must have done something really awful. But there he is, Scottish, you know, the Scottish independence, the world of Braveheart, locking people up. And because he made a video. So, yep. The rest of the world is even in worse stead for most large parts of it. And then we're about to probably enter who knows what war where, whether it's Venezuela, whether it's Ethiopia, whether it's where it looks like Ukraine. We see it sort of, wholesale and broad scale, and it's scary and frightening in many capacities. But you're one of the key people building the sort of an integral component of what I loosely call the real resistance to this kind of mindset mentality. Another guy doing his own little bit is Tim Pool. You're often on Tim's show.
Every other Wednesday.
A little skater hacker guy. What's your take on that whole watching Tim's rise and being on the show?
All right. First thing about Tim Pool, he's the hardest working man I know. Okay. That dude cranks out 5-6 videos a day and then does a 2-hour podcast every night. And of course, that's not just 2 hours. That's 4 hours, an hour on either end, right? That dude cranks and he has been consistent and hardworking for years, years. Dude has earned everything that he's got. He's got an empire. Bro, does he have an empire and a huge reach. I was the first guest on Tim Pool as podcast back in February of last year before pre-corona. I'm on there every other Wednesday. I'll be on next week. And since I've been on Tim Pool now for about 8 or 9 months, I get recognized walking down the street. And I used to get that occasionally in DC every once in a while that would happen to me. And certainly at any sort of political event, people know me very well. But I am getting recognized now. I go into a restaurant. People come out from the kitchen to say thank you because they watched him pool. I went to a hotel. And first thing that happens, I walk in. People are like, oh, my God, Jack Murphy, Tim Pool. People cross the street, dog walkers. I'm with my kids. People are like, oh, my God, are you Jack Murphy? Are you Jack Murphy? My kids are like, whoa. I guess what they call my words in the basement, writing my book in the basement like 3 years ago, paid off. And they're starting to see that. So Tim is part of an essential component of the free media, right? You guys remember when we were younger, there was that movie, Christian Slater. I can't remember what it was called, but he was like a pirate radio host.
With Winona Ryder, it was, the chat's going to get it in 30 seconds. It had a number in the title, I think.
So being a pirate radio host sounded real cool back then in the 80s, right? And basically that's where we are now, pirate radio, right? We can broadcast out to the whole universe, not just something local. You can say whatever you want, more or less. And you can reach just a ton of people.
And, pump up the volume, by the way.
What's that?
Pump up the volume.
Oh, yeah, pump up the volume. Exactly right. And so I feel like right now I'm living the dream, honestly. I am so perfectly aligned with my personal values, with my mission in life, my day-to-day action, the impact that I'm having on the world. And now I also know that my personal values and the values of the liminal order and the thing that I'm doing every day are the actual values that we need in order to save Western civilization. I could not be in any more perfect alignment. And I feel like I am being propelled across a frictionless surface. I wake up every day thrilled. I can't go to sleep at night because I got so much going on in my head and I'm excited to do everything. The podcast is picking up like crazy. The guest list is just so impressive. I'm honored with the people that come on and give me their time and allow me to pick their brains. I'm going to keep pushing that. I've hired a producer, re-upped all of the graphics. I got a whole new studio here in the house. I'm just going to keep pushing that. We're going to keep growing the liminal order and we're going to keep living our values, embodying our values. Walk the walk, guys. It's the manliest thing you can do is live your values.
Absolutely. Well, I realize we can tie in Jack to Count Dankula did a good, his little series, Mad Lads series, where he talks about Blackbeard. So I realize that's who Jack is currently reminding me of. All you got to do is tie some little explosives to the bottom of the beard. and this is my book reference for the night, The World Atlas of Pirates. Nice. Pirates are actually great populist revolutionaries of their own kind. Half of them were freed slaves. I'm still waiting for woke Hollywood, the supposed, you know, actually I pitched this idea to Wes. He was actually interested. He may do it because it'd be like him because he's on his own political world. But, you know, people forget that half of pirates were freed slaves. They don't realize that the first true sort of slave rebellion were in part the pirates. And they were uniting with working class whites who were mistreated on sailors that were notoriously mistreated. Many of them had been indentured onto ships originally. And they were taken from folks who didn't need it and given it to those who did. And a democratized entrepreneurial mechanism of wealth allocation outside of the institutional control.
Redistribution of assets. So funny thing. Sorry. Funny thing. Inside the LO, my nickname is Blackbeard. Definitely. And I draw a rhetorical reference to Bronze Age pervert as well. There's a lot going on in his book, Bronze Age Mindset. Everyone should read it. Take what you want, leave the rest. But one of the key things that he talks about is that the world needs pirates. We need outlaws. We need people that are willing to set sail for a destination unknown, seeking adventure and conflict, to be independent and sovereign. And I think that's the prime message in that book as well.
All right. And that might be the best way to end this. Jack, Robert, obviously, thank you as always. Stick around, Jack, Robert. We'll say our proper goodbyes. Everyone in the chat, thank you very much. Drop a thumbs up before you leave and leave a comment to blast up the chat there.
And there'll be a live chat after party that I'll drop in at vivabarneslaw.locals.com.
Can I drop a couple plugs real quick, bro?
Absolutely.
Everywhere people can reach you.
All right. Liminal-order.com. If you are a man who believes in the power of masculinity, brotherhood, and sovereignty, please join the email list. New emails every Monday. And you have an opportunity to join once a month at the beginning of the month. Follow me on Twitter at Jack Murphy Live and go to the YouTube channel. Y'all are on YouTube right now. Tell you what, it's Jack Murphy Live. Head on over there. Hit the subscribe button. New videos every day, new podcasts every week. And every Friday, we have a bomb panel discussion. Have to get you guys on there as well, too. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Any day. And I'm going to put all those links in the pinned comment as well so you can all find them more easily. I just may ask Jack to send them to me afterwards. But that's it. And everyone, enjoy the week.